Colourful, a podcast where we explore how race shapes our experiences. I'm Stacey Jane, a white woman and mom of two living in Cape Town, looking to challenge the systems of privilege.
And I'm Sena Zungu, a black woman living in Johannesburg, passionate about interrogating power dynamics and the intersection of identities. Our vision, to spark candid and open dialogues for a more equitable and inclusive South Africa.
We're not afraid to have uncomfortable conversations because we believe that complacency only perpetuates injustice.
Ultimately, we aim to bridge divides through empathy and understanding. Sometimes we laugh, sometimes we cry, but at least we're doing it together. Welcome to Colourful.
So Sena, I was recently chatting to a friend of mine, and she mentioned to me that she and the rest of her senior team were busy prepping for some big shots that were coming down from overseas. They were coming to South Africa. She said, well, you know, there's going to be these slick presentations. They're going to select like our top three star performing black employees to deliver these presentations. They're going to do it with just the right balance of professionalism and like fun to showcase that we have this great workplace culture. And then she got really frustrated and said, and then they're going to call on me to take everybody through these township tours where I'll have to tell them about things like black culture and Ubuntu. And then she specifically referenced the fact that she always seemed to have to explain what a shisanyama is. And she said, I don't understand why they asked me to do that, because yes, I'm black, but I didn't even grow up in Soweto. I grew up in KZN. And she said, why is it okay that white people will never be asked to lead a township tour, that they kind of step out of their comfort spaces in the suburbs and actually go and explore how the rest of them live?
Actually, Stacey, research from the University of Missouri shows that, well, actually identified this as the paradox of the black professional, in that, you know, the assumption is, or the base like assumption and practices that underlie a kind of professional environment or professionalism is in its essence white. So even like the very definition of what is a professional is based on white culture. And in order to like advance in their career, not only to advance, but as a means of self-preservation, black professionals often have to embrace this culture. And this dynamic kind of traps them, where on one hand, they feel really pressured to conform to white cultural norms in order to succeed. And on the other hand, they're also expected to be the face of diversity, equity, and inclusion in their organizations. So navigating this is like something that I call invisible labor. And it is exactly the situation that your friend described. So if we really want to like embrace diversity and inclusion, we really need to rethink the whole concept of professionalism before just sending people on countless leadership courses.
Yeah, Sena, I have to admit that I have actually seen that kind of thing happen across the multiple corporates that I have worked in. I'm not sure that people would necessarily have realized that that is the type of behavior that we engage in. And so here today, to help us discuss and challenge and consider these forward-looking solutions to assimilation into white workspaces is award-winning Hello. Entrepreneur and author of 6 books, an international speaker who has consulted with businesses on the benefits of diversity with cultural intelligence for over 18 years. He has met and worked with leaders such as Nelson Mandela and received a nation-building award from Archbishop Desmond Tutu. He holds certificates from Harvard and is a fellow with the Cultural Intelligence Center in Michigan. He serves as faculty for many executive leadership programs across Cornell University and Duke Corporate Education. He is also a faculty member for the United Nations Global Executive Leadership Initiative and is currently a director at Tomorrow Today Global, helping clients develop the contextual intelligence to help build effective organizational cultures. Uthli Dlamini, it is truly an honor to welcome you to Colourful today.
Thank you very much, Stacey. And Sena, thank you for the opportunity to be part of this. I think these are really, really important conversations that you're having. Tough conversations, difficult conversations, but I'm glad that you're doing it and I get to be part of it.
Welcome, Buhle. Could you please start just by telling our listeners a little bit more about yourself and your family?
Yes, I think sometimes the profile and the blurbs, they kind of like give you that professional speak about the person, and you kind of like say, oh, that's very, very impressive, blah, blah, blah. But the reality is like, who is this guy really? Well, I'm based in Nova Scotia, Canada right now, and I have been here for the last 10 years. And that's usually the question that people say is like, what's a Zulu boy from South Africa doing in a place like Nova Scotia out of all places? And then that's how I launch into my story. Well, that's because I'm married. I'm married to Stacey, not Stacey Jane, but Stacey Lamini now. Stacey and I have been married for 21 years. And Stacey's originally from here in Nova Scotia. And so we got married at almost 22 years now in South Africa. We have four children, and our oldest is 35. Her name is Bijou, and she is originally from Congo. She was at a children's home in Soweto. And Stacey and I were just newly married, and we heard a story, and we knew we had to get involved. So that's how come we're newly married, and we had a young teenager. Our second child is now 27 years old. His name is Nhlanhla. The good thing about him is that he looks a lot like me, and that's because he's my brother. Both my parents passed away. And when he was about 8 years old, just when we got the teenager, we also got an eight-year-old. And so it was really an instant family, as it were. So because both children moved in almost at the same time. And then we were blessed to have our first biological child and our third child. And so her name is Trinity. And she is now 18, getting ready to go to university. So you can imagine how that's like for the family. And then our last born, his name is Kaya, and he is 13 years old. So we have a little bit of diversity in our own family. As you can tell, we've got two Zulus, we've got this blonde Canadian, we've got a Congolese, and two coloreds, Nochal. You know, all in this one family. And as a South African, I lived in South Africa and started my business Young and Able in South Africa. I was involved with Heartlines, a mass media initiative. And I've had a lot of opportunities to continue to work in South Africa. I go back about at minimum three times a year. So I'm looking forward to the time when I'm going to be back later this year.
Looking forward to meeting with you and your family when you're in South Africa. I know you're coming quite soon. So, Botle, thank you. Thanks for being here today and sharing a little bit about your family. In Reni Edo-Lodge's book, Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race, she challenges these sort of non-racists by saying that it's easy to justify apathy with the idea that if an actual racist attack hasn't occurred, then an action or even a non-action can't really be seen as racist. So we're going to explore that idea in a few minutes. But before we do, I know that your family has actually been the product of a targeted racist attack. Would you be comfortable telling us what happened?
Sure. And I often preface this by saying that discrimination doesn't need to be violent to affect people in the workplace. And sometimes when discrimination is not addressed, it can lead to adverse consequences for people that are affected by it. And so, as you heard about Nhlanhla, my brother and my son, he was affected. This was just before 2020. As a young worker, he was about 22 at the time, and he was the only person of color. He's in construction. So here in Canada, every home is built with wood as opposed to brick and cement. And so he's a carpenter by trade. And so he was working for this company. He'd only worked there for 3 weeks. And in that whole time, you know, he was subjected to racial discrimination in jokes, nickname calling. So basically they had a nickname for him that was a disguised N-word. So he was shot with a nail gun at work in the back. And that actually resulted in him getting a punctured lung, ending up in hospital for 3 days. And this became such a big story here in Canada that we were plastered all over the news, and the court case took over 3 years to go through. By the time the conviction happened, the perpetrator was found guilty, but the actual sentence was really a slap on the wrist, because he was given house arrest at the time when we were all under house arrest during the pandemic. And so, yes, justice in one hand looked like it had been done, but on the other, it had really not been done. And I think one of the biggest things is that when you are in a small community like we are here, I mean, when we moved here, we literally doubled the diversity of the town just by moving in, right? And so when you are in an environment like that, what really disturbed me most was often people's disbelief that it was racism. You know, like people are like, no, that's not how we are. No, let's find another explanation as to why this happened. It couldn't have been racism. People were more willing to go with that it was an accident. And so when it comes to racism, I think as a family coming from South Africa, that was the last thing we expected that would happen to us, especially being a person that speak on diversity and inclusion, and that I would have my own story that was so very close to home.
Yeah. Okay, I think as you were describing that story, first of all, I'd like to say my sympathies to you and your family and all my empathy. That must have been very difficult. But something, as you were speaking, detailing the court case, struck me. And it is this notion of, this notion of what it looks like, what justice, equity, what transformation looks like on paper, and how that plays out practically. And so when we discuss racism and prejudice as a system, this is exactly like what we mean. On the laws may be very clear, the policies may be in place, but how that translates on an everyday sort of scenario is far from what it looks like on paper. So it's this almost formal equality, and then substantively, it is a different experience. And so the structures of racism are everywhere, judicially, in the workplace. And so as you were describing that, that's just what dawned on me. And I'm so sorry to hear about that experience.
Absolutely, Sena. I think that's it. When we talk about racism or any of the isms that plague us in our workplaces, it's really about understanding that there is a system that's in place that is always at work. And it needs to be dismantled by people first understanding how it looks like, how it shows up, and then being willing to call it out and to challenge it and to actually bring about real change. Because again, racism is racism until it's your son, until it's your family. It's just something that you see in the news. It's just something out there. It's George Floyd. It's someone else.
Yeah. And Butle, you mentioned in a chat that we had offline, and you said to me, the honeymoon period with George Floyd is definitely over. Can you tell our listeners what you meant by that when you mentioned that to me?
I think what happened with George Floyd really was a moment in time. I mean, we were all under quarantine, and all of us were glued on our screens. And it captured the moment in a way that it hadn't before. There had been many incidents that in some ways were worse than what actually happened to George Floyd before then. But the attention of the world was not there. And so what happened with this incident is that the whole attention of the world was there. And so then the reaction around the world in terms of the protests, in terms of the walkouts, the actual challenges where people were saying the enough is enough, our organizations need to do something, our systems need to do something, that everybody realized we've got to do something. And so there was this flurry of reactions from governments to corporates to whoever. And it was good, at a good moment for bringing about change and bringing about transformation. But I think what is always a problem with such sort of like rapid changes or that are driven by emergencies is that it's very easy for people to make statements or to make policy changes that are really just based on trying to look good and trying to be seen on the right side of the thing. And a lot of that happened. And what has happened since then is actually a regression that's worse than what we were dealing with before. The way that we look at the progress in the space of diversity and inclusion and equity, we look at the period leading up to the election of Barack Obama, two terms in the office, because this is on the global stage. That looks like this is the pinnacle of of dismantling racism, dismantling a bias, dismantling all of these things. And then you have this period which after that, where it's like pushback, and then the height of it is the George Floyd scenario. And then again, the pendulum swings, and the whole concept of woke and anti-woke then comes into the picture, which is really the period where you find that those against progress when it comes to the issue, the space of diversity and inclusion and equity, actually organize themselves in ways that we had never seen before. They organize themselves to take control of all systems, to take control of the judicial system in the Supreme Court, to take control of the legal parameters, to take control of legislative arms, and so on, and started actively working against and making anything to do with diversity, equity, and inclusion be seen to be counterproductive or to be counter-progress. And so you started hearing people saying things like the woke mob to refer to anybody who promotes diversity. And you started hearing people talk about being anti-woke as if woke is a bad word. And it was actually the misappropriation of the term woke itself that has actually brought about what we see now, a complete walking back of all policies and systems. So you've got whole states that have actually instituted programs and policies that are actually against diversity and inclusion.
Well, yeah, I'd love to pick your brain a little bit about how that plays out in South Africa. Mm. So a lot of what you're describing are systems that I think we are aware of that are certainly playing out in American spaces. One of the things that I hear quite frequently in my circles is the challenge for white men to be promoted, to be put forward for certain positions. But I'm curious to understand whether your perspective on that conversation. Is that another example of this backward movement that you mentioned?
Absolutely. So it's so important to always remember that what happens on a global stage always has impact across the world. And so what's been very, very interesting in the South African context, for example, is that even what happens in South Africa gets taken and used globally to promote some of these things. And so in South Africa, there's been a rise in the narrative of of white people and white men being targets of reverse racism, or being targets of farm killings and so on. And so those stories actually get amplified outside of South Africa and get used to actually fuel the kind of, of the things that we're seeing where it's pushed back against diversity and inclusion. In the South African context, the way that it works is that it gives people permission. So what happens when people like Elon Musk use their position and their platforms to promote anti-diversity and inclusion rhetoric it gives people who gives people in South Africa sort of like that permission to say, yeah, I agree with this, and they will reshare and so on. And so the impact of what's happening on the global stage creates the right conditions for people to feel that they're emboldened and to feel that they now there's a movement that allows them to say certain things that they probably would not have been able to say without that global context.
I think as you were speaking there, it came to me that especially in the time that we're in South Africa, we're in election season. And a lot of that rhetoric, you're seeing it around. But also that sort of rhetoric is always really based on, they use certain facts to legitimize or mask the fact that it is so anti-DEI. So there'll be certain things that they blame it on, where it's like, you know, DEI is not, it has nothing to do with productivity, or is actually hurting our opportunities for, like, you know, closing the unemployment gap. So it always seems like they find, or these kinds of, this kind of rhetoric is based on some sort of like fact that has been morphed in order to suit it. So that you can present the argument as logical and devoid of emotion and therefore valid.
Wilkie, I'd like to chat about the paradox of the black professional, this impossible feat of acting white in order to be seen as a professional within the workplace culture that is Eurocentric at its foundation. I guess a lot of people describe this as assimilation and that they're unable to get ahead in the workplace. And it's made a lot worse by the fact that white people simply don't see it. And I have to be very honest here and say that I don't think I was aware of this either. This particular idea that professionalism itself was developed in a Eurocentric manner and that it expects people to act a certain way to be seen as professionals.
Yes, and so the term that's often used to describe this assimilation or acceptable behavior is there are quite a few terms that I use. One of them is called code switching, which usually refers to people feeling that they have to change the essence of who they are in an environment in order for them to succeed and to move forward. And again, I think it's very, very important that when we talk about diversity and what diversity matters most, that we think about what are we talking about? Because different places have different challenges. And so I always say there's two types of diversity we need to be thinking about. We need to be thinking about visible diversity, what you see. So that is your race. Gender, and so it's what you actually see, because what happens is that in the first 5 seconds of meeting someone, your biases kick in just based on how they look like and based on what you see. And so visible diversity is quite important. So in the context where, people of color are a minority, like in North America and in Europe and so on, it's when we talk about visible diversity, it's often about representation and so on and so forth. In places where black people and people that are often referred to as minorities in other places actually are a majority, but in workspaces, they actually are not a majority as you go throughout the organization. So then that's why visible diversity matters there, because yes, you might have an organization that has, a huge representation of black people at lower levels, but as you go through the organization, that's no longer seen. And so what tends to happen in those situations is that then people of color feel that in order for them to rise in that organization, they have to act certain ways, they have to sound a certain way. And so there's a sense of losing a part of yourself. There's a sense of checking yourself in at the turnstile, leaving the essence of who you are in order to assimilate. And And when you get home or when you are with people like yourself at a different, it almost feels like you can breathe and you can be yourself. So that's code switching is one word that is often used, and it all has to do with psychological safety, and so if the psychological safety for people to be authentic to who they are is there, then you won't have that code switching prevalent. So organizations that do this very well are the ones that say, we want you because you have something special to add to this organization, but we want all of you. We don't want the sanitized version of you, or we don't want the whitewashed version of you.
Yeah, thank you, Bukle. And that is something that we want to address in a future episode, is practically speaking, what does that mean for workplaces who want to who don't want to whitewash? Sena, I know you've spent some time talking to people who want to share some of their stories with us today.
Yes, I have. So we kind of asked our listeners to share some workplace assimilation stories with us. And I must just say, I must thank the listeners that do engage with us on our platforms, and also thank them for sharing their personal stories. So I'm going to just paraphrase a few stories that we received, Bukle, and I'm so keen to like tie it in with exactly everything you just described about code switching and basically feeling psychologically not safe to be authentic. So the first story is about an individual who spoke to us about how whiteness really manifests itself in microaggressive ways in the workplace. So she used an example of bringing a prepared lunch to work and, you know, a very traditional, you know, ethnic dish, like something like a mangina or ucheg. And she says that she would come to work, open this up, and the kind of looks she would get from colleagues and like inquiries she would get from colleagues, almost like, oh, what an interesting smell, or like, oh, I also like putu, very much underscored the fact that she was the other. So exactly as you said, Bukle, it is, even though in South Africa, Black people and people of color form the majority, very much in a lot of spaces where the culture is not, they're not the majority, they're the minority. So she said that it got to a point where she was so tired of constantly being reminded that she's the other. And she was so tired of getting quizzed that eventually she started just packing pasta and salads to work because she couldn't stand the microaggressions.
I think that is such a prevalent example that affects a lot of cultures that are underrepresented in an organization or and so on. So that's the second type of diversity that often comes, is underrepresented group. So in that example, you're seeing exactly how that now is impacting how a person has to prepare a whole different meal in order to bring to work instead of having what they might have had as a leftover at home. And that has impacts on how then that person feels in that environment and how that they show up. And it has an impact on productivity. It has an impact it even affects innovation and creativity, because creativity has to be rooted in authenticity. It's often when we are authentic that our creative juices flow and that we're able to find the best in ourselves. And when we feel that we have to be inauthentic, then creativity is stifled.
Yeah, I completely couldn't agree more. I'm going to touch on another story. And this one speaks to kind of navigating, again, this very white corporate space. And this individual feels as though they're constantly towing the line between embodying wild culture, but also embracing their Blackness only when it suits and is beneficial to the company. So she gives an example of genuinely being just very jovial, you know, loud and very free. And so she exhibits that she's herself as a Black woman in the office. And she said that her manager pulled her aside to tell her that they've been complaints about around the office about how loud and disruptive she could be. And she was asked to tone it down. And when she spoke to like her other colleagues, they were like, what do you mean? Like, what do you mean tone it down? They couldn't believe that she'd been told that she's essentially unprofessional by her white colleagues. But meanwhile, she gives an example saying that there's another white male in her office who walks around with the arrogance and obnoxiousness that only a white male can get away with, making inappropriate remarks. And he is celebrated as being funny and harmless. So she says that she did tone it down, but a few months down the line, the company was kind of gearing up to host an event. And as they were planning, the colleagues were looking to Black people, the Black colleagues, for almost every aspect of the event, what to eat, which performers to bring through. And she says to that her surprise, the very same manager who told her to tone it down, called her and asked her if she could MC the event because she has that vibe. And so she says she was floored. I was being asked to embrace my Blackness as and when it suited white people. That's the thing about white hegemony. They get to pick and choose which parts of Black culture they like, but never really fully embrace diversity.
And I think this is one example again that just shows you the challenge that comes with not moving from just being a diverse organization to being an inclusive organization. And I think what we have today is that we have diverse organizations because it's 2024. And I know I always laugh and smile when someone uses the year as if to say that, it's 2024. It's like, the race is forgot, it's 2024, and we have to sort of like bring the date in front of them and say, hey, it's 2024, you can't call me that, or you can't treat me that way, but so diversity is a given, it's here. But this is where the challenge comes, is that diversity in itself is not enough. And so we have to heed the words of Vinay Myers when she said, diversity is being invited to the party, whereas inclusion is being asked to dance. And I think that's where we are in most of our organizations today. We've got diversity. We've got the different colors of the Smarty box. We've got the different crayons, but we haven't actually moved on into inclusion. And so what inclusion says in that particular situation is that let's increase everybody's ability first to understand the differences that we bring. And then secondly, to create a space that allows those differences to flourish. So in other words, it means that people don't have to stop who they are in order to fit in, but actually people need to increase their awareness and their understanding of each other so that they will understand when they deal with these different cultural values, how do you navigate that as a team? And so I think most of the time we're talking around in circles when we have these conversations because we are not focusing on the equipping, the skill development side of things. We are talking about more about the problem, the challenge, or sort of like diagnosing the symptoms. And I think that's one of the reasons why I believe we're going to continue to have these until we are really serious about saying, how do we move to an inclusive space? And what are some of the skills and tools that teams need to have?
Both Senna and I, we want to thank you for joining us today. Can you please let our listeners know, especially those that are responsible for workplace culture, where they can find you and follow you?
So absolutely. You can connect with me at buhledlamini.com as well as find me on LinkedIn. I find that platform to be quite a good platform. I usually put out some of what I'm doing, some videos and some of the insights that I'm sharing, as well as, of course, tomorrowtodayglobal.com. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to you. Let's keep having the conversations. Let's not be scared. You cannot transform what you will not confront. So let's keep having these conversations.
Thank you, Buhle. We hope that you enjoyed today's episode, and we really encourage you to subscribe to Colorful Podcast on Spotify, Apple, or YouTube, with episodes out every 2 weeks. Please rate us, comment, and share with your community so that we keep the conversation going.